Right, ladies. This, as I said to you before, is the last of the little mini-series on Elu Ve'elu. And we have a lot of very critical things to discuss today, things which I think you'll find interesting. We are moving on, Be'ezrat Hashem, from here to more in historical theme, because we haven't talked about anything historical for about 4 or 5 weeks. Oh, well, maybe a bit less than that. And we need to pick it up in the middle of the second Beit HaMikdash and work through and understand how things rolled out, because I want to start getting into the sugyas of how the Mishnah and the Gemara were put together and formed, etc. There's a little way to go before that. I want towards Hanukkah, I want to be talking about the whole Greek period, which is exactly where we're going to be right then, and really what's going on with the Greeks on a halachic level. The translation of the Torah into 70 by the 70 rabbis there, and how that fits in with everything, etc. Again, I also want to talk to you about the big black hole of the missing 160 something missing years in the Second Temple period, and what happened to them, and different sheets on that. Really fascinating stuff. Why our Jewish dating system seems to have fallen out of kilter with the secular one, and who's right, who's wrong, and maybe Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elohim Chaim, but I doubt it on that. We'll see what the answers are. So that, there's all sorts of it. I want to talk about Kitab Ivri. What's Kitab Ivri?
The ancient.
The ancient Ivrit sort of scripts, which is a sort of scrawly one, which is, what do they call it, Paleo-Canaanite, whatever, Paleo-Hebrew or something like that. I want to talk about that and understand what happened to it, where it came, the different sheetahs in the Gemara. Yeah, so that's just scrolls are a mixture of different things, but for example, where Taf is written like this, that's a Taf. Yeah, in this, instead of being like this, and all the letters in there. If you look, we'll see. We'll talk about it. If you look at it,
Torah was written like that.
That's the big machlokes, and there's a big debate in the Gemara Sanhedrin, which we need to see how the sources deal with that. But it's very interesting, and it throws light on the way that we understand things today too. Fine, but we're not there yet. Second semester, that gets really exciting. We have a load bunch of things to do. So there's a long way to go. We're only on sheet 24, and maybe for sheet 80. Okay, yes. We'll talk about it when we talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. We may even do a field trip. How would you like that?
Yeah.
Probably not really. No, I don't think we can't get there and back in 2 hours though.
No, it's okay.
And I'm not buying you all lunch.
Lunch.
Yeah, but what are you going to do for lunch?
We'll bring lunch.
All right. Maybe you should try and plan in a field trip. I'll talk to Mrs. Isaacson about it. It's fun, you know. Get on a bus, go out, etc. Fine. Or you can all try and fit in the back of my car, but I don't know what's happening. Now, Elu Ve'elu. Let's go. Elu Ve'elu and Midrash. This very strange story of the Pilegesh Megivah. The Sefer Shoftim is full of challenging, difficult, upsetting stories. Pesel Micha, various Shoftim that behaved in less than perfect ways. Yiftach.
And why did you learn it in Greek school?
No, it makes sense if you explain it right and you learn it right, because it's meant to be easier to learn than Sefer Yecheskel, so that's why they learn it lower down the chain. But at the end of at the very end of the book, there's this episode of the Pilegesh Megivah, which is this guy, he marries a Pilegesh, she misbehaves, we'll just debate here why and how. She gets thrown out, she goes back to live with her father, she finds herself back at the guy's house, he won't let her in, and she stays the night outside on the front door. She gets attacked, raped and abused and perhaps murdered by the locals from Binyamin. They lived in Binyamin. And now he opens the door the next day, he sees her draped over the step at the front. He assumes that she's dead, but it's not totally clear from the psukim that she really is. But then he cuts her into pieces and sends her around the rest of Klal Yisrael as if you like an alert, saying, this is what's happening in Binyamin. My Pilegesh was abused and killed, and I'm sending her body parts around to you so you can take action, because obviously people are a bit shocked when they open her, like, you know, whatever it is from all those people that send the mail around the world. No, I'm thinking of DHL. DHL, when you get a DHL and you open it up and it's some leg or arm or something like that. Obviously, and what then ensues is a major civil war. That the rest of the tribes of Israel declare war, civil war on the tribe of Binyamin. And they said, this is how you hate, we're going to wipe you out. And they were wiped out, other than a few hundred people that were left, from which they tried to rebuild the tribe, etc. So it was a very, very challenging, difficult part of Jewish history. So let's have a look at number one. In those days it was, there was no order, there was no law, there was no government, there was no sense of security. There was this Levi. He lived in the north. Har Ephraim is up in the Shomron. Okay? If you go up now to Shiloh. You into Shiloh? Go up to Sheila around there. That's the beginning of the Har Ephraim. Vayikach lo isha, pilegesh. He took a pilegesh, a concubine. It's a very interesting sugi as to whether you're allowed to have a concubine, not allowed to have, only a king can have a concubine, or everyone can have a concubine. A concubine, a pilegesh, is basically a wife with no ksuba. It's not a casual relationship. It's a real fixed relationship. She can't go off and, you know, go live with someone else. But she doesn't have the formalities, the legal formalities, the monetary formalities of a wife. The Beit Lechem Yehuda? From Beit Lechem Yehuda. Where's Beit Lechem Yehuda?
5 minutes from us.
5 minutes from us. Why is it called Beit Lechem Yehuda?
So,
but we call it Yerushalayim Yehuda, and you don't call it Hebron Yehuda. You just call it Beit Lechem Yehuda. Why is Beit Lechem Yehuda? Why do you think?
There was another city
named Lechem. Where is that? Beit Lechem Aglilit. Beit Lechem Aglilit in the north. You can go past it in the car when you go towards Yokneam. There's a sign for Beit Lechem Aglilit. There were two sounds from called Beit Lechem. Fine. Vatizne alav hapilagsho. She does a znut. Now znut sometimes, but not always, refers to something sexual and unfaithful. But it doesn't have to relate to that. She rebelled in something. She behaved very badly in some way. Vatelech nitoi. She had to leave him. El bet avia, back to her father's house. El bet lechem Yehuda. Vatisham yamim arba chadashim. She was there for 4 months. Fine. Now, says the Gemara, what is the aveira? Vatizne alav pilagsho. What did she do? So look at number two. Rabbi Yatar Abba Amar Zvuv Matsala. Rabbi Eviatar said he found a fly. Where did he find a fly? Not clear. Rabbi Yonatan Amar Rabbi Yonatan said Nima Matsala. He found a hair. Okay. Where? Not clear. Now, Ashkechei Rabbi Yonatali Eliyahu Rabbi Yonatar meets up with Eliyahu Anavi. Always a good person to meet. Amalei said to him, My Kavi Kushibrichu, what's God doing right now? Tell me, what's God doing? You have a hotline? What's he doing? Amalei said to him, Asik b'pileg b'shkiva? Would you believe it? He's learning the sugya of pileg b'shkiva. Very handy. Excellent. So says Rabbi Yatzai Vatar, that's brilliant. My karma, what's he say? Did he say like me? Or did he say like the other guy? Tell me he says like me. Go on, tell me. Amalei said to him, no, God's actually learning both shittas. Eviatar b'ni kachomet. My son Eviatar says like this. It was the flight. V'yonatan b'ni kachomata. Yonatan, my child, says the other way. Like it was the hair. So now Rabbi Yatzai is really upset. Amalei said to him, Chas v'sholom. Chas v'sholom. Call yourself Eliyahu Novi. That's not possible. Mi ikas veke kamishamaya. Is it possible that God doesn't know? Does God not know what happened? So Eliyahu answers him and he says to him, smiles at him, I assume, and says to him, listen, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chan. These are the living words of God. What, this is, by the way, there's only two places in Shas where Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chan is mentioned. Here, on this Midrashic question, and over in Erevin on Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, which we learned 2 times ago, right? These are the only two mentions. What does Eliyahu HaNavi mean when he says Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chan? So, one answer, the Gemara gives 3 responses. How could that be? Zvuv matzav aloi hikpid. Again, when Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chan in Halacha, which is the other source, it says Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel couldn't agree on the Halacha. So you can say Elu ve'elu, meaning when it comes to Halacha, you're not talking about a historical issue. You're talking about the way you read things, the way you learn things. Okay, I understand. From what we've seen, there's different ways of learning things in different ways. But when it's a historical question, how can you say Elu ve'elu? Doesn't God know what happened? Apparently, that's not the point. But the Gemara says like this, he tries to fit them in historically first. Zvug, Matzav Eloi Hikpid. He found a fly and he wasn't that bothered. So there was a fly, but that wasn't the end. Nima Matzav Eloi Hikpid. But then he found a fly, he found a hair, and that brought the camels back. The hair that broke the marriage. Okay? So then he threw her out. So in other words, it was both. Oh, so let's look now. So the second opinion clarifies. I'm a Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says, Zvuv Bekaira. The Zvuv was in his food. Meaning, he was cutting through his food one day and he found a cockroach or something like that, and he was really unhappy with it. Nima, but the hair, the Oisamakam. Now, one of the groups I actually mentioned what this was, but what did you understand Otomakom to be?
In the same place.
In the same place. Could be Oisamakom, but it's not here.
Same time.
Same time, it wouldn't be Makom. Oisamakom, Otomakom, is a euphemistic way that the rabbis refer to the female private parts. You weren't expecting that, right? Meaning, there is no word in Hebrew for any of the sexual parts of the body. That's why the Rambam says, Lasaginor means that kind of thing. Yeah, euphemistic in that way. But the Rambam makes a point and says that Loshon HaKodesh is called Loshon HaKodesh because it has no vulgarity in it. Even though there's nothing vulgar about sexuality, referring to certain things in a very crass, vulgar way is inappropriate, and therefore there is no word in Loshon HaKodesh for A, there's no swear word. There is no swear word in Loshon HaKodesh. In modern Hebrew, when they invented modern Hebrew, they said, well, it's kind of a language without swear words. Like, you know, what is that? And therefore, they brought in swear words either from Arabic, of which there are many, but I don't know them, but I bet my kids know a few of them, just because they've heard other people say them, you know. There are words in English. They use all the English swear words, all the standards, all the old-timers, but they use them in different contexts. It gets very confusing, because the way that you'd say a certain word in North America or England that might be very strong or quite weak, the same word in modern Hebrew can be quite different.
Yeah.
And you have to learn that in order to... Look, my suggestion is don't say any of them. But, you know, I'm saying, or they took words in Hebrew, proper Loshon HaKodesh, which were not in the slightest swear word, and they just said, okay, that's going to be a swear word. Like Azazel. Azazel is not a swear word. It means something in the Chumash. But they turn it into a swear word. Okay, fine. Because they can't have Hebrew without swear words. Similarly, there are no words in Loshon HaKodesh for the male private parts, for the female private parts. They always give them euphemisms. It's very interesting. Again, that's not because, you know, sexuality is dirty or that. That's a very much not a Jewish response. But they're speaking in a certain way is inappropriate. So Oseh Makom means he found a hair in that place. Why? Because it was standard in the ancient world and in many parts of the modern world that the women would shave off all their body hair. And it was considered highly inappropriate for them to have any body hair. And he got really upset because she hadn't done this. Look at what it says. It says, Zvuv mi susa. The fly made him feel ill because he found a, you know, fly in his food. Nima, but the hair for cancer was dangerous. Because they held, or many people held, that one of the reasons that the women shaved their body hair off because it was dangerous if, like, when they were having marital relations, something might go wrong, he might get upset, you know, not upset, but he might get damaged in some way, she might get damaged in some way. So he said, this is, I can't deal with this anymore, out you go. By the way, this guy is not sad. Someone who chops up his pelegesh when he's not even sure that she's dead, and sends him to, this guy is not the hero of the story by any means. So don't go and say, how can you do that? The answer is you can't.
But,
Yeah. It was like, it's really not very nice at all. Ika da Amri, and the third view is, Idi da Idi Bakara, they were both in the place, there was nothing to do with the sexuality. Zvuv anusa, the zvuv, what could she do? She couldn't help it, the fly flies in the plate, nothing she could do about it. But Nima shiuta, but the hair was negligent. Meaning, the Gemara tries to fit in both of these opinions to fit, somehow they both were historically true. But we'll see that there's a whole other approach which doesn't do this, which is very much the approach of the more modern Mephoroshim and the Rishonim as well, that no, when it comes to a historical event, actually, and this is the point of the Shir, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim means this. When you look at something which happened in history, from a Jewish perspective, we are not bothered about the historical reality. It's less interesting to us. I mean, there may be a historical reality, it may be important for some purposes, but really what we're interested in is not the historical reality, but the religious reality. Meaning, let's take the following cases that I brought here. How old was Yitzchak at the Akedah? So what did the sources say? I'm not going to read them all. What did Rashi say?
37.
Where did he get that from? What did he get it from? Come on, girls, you just learnt it. Where did he get it from, Rashi? How old was Sarah when she died? 127. So what's that got to do with Yitzchak? She died when he was at the Akedah, and also it says Rivka was born just then, and Rivka, they were 40 when they got married. So since all these events, in terms of Pshat, in terms of the Chumash, connect with each other, maybe not Pshat, maybe Drash, but they connect with each other, in other words, the order of the Chumash is Akedah, Rivka's birth, Sarah's death. That's the order that it comes. So says Rashi from Chazal, that all of these things are temporally connected. They all happened at the same time, which comes out that therefore Yitzchak was 37, and how old was Rivka when he...
3.
Now, comes along the Ibn Ezra and says, look at what the Ibn Ezra says. The first line is important. V'chazal amru shehaya Yitzchak ha'ashenekah ben shloshim v'sheva shanim. Says the Ibn Ezra, our tradition is from Chazal that he was 37. The im divrei kabbalah. This is a real Kabbalah, meaning if this is something they got from Masora, Mikabel, meaning Mikabel. We'll take it. We'll go with it. I'll accept it. I'm not going to argue with Chazal. But miderech hasvara ein zenachol. But on the basis of svara, just on pshat, look at the psukim. Why does Yitzhak have to be 37? And on the contrary, it makes sense to say he's not 37. Why does it say it makes sense to say he's not 37? He would have got schar for that. In other words, what is it? Who did it test for? Yitzhak or Avram? Avram. If you're telling me he was taking his 37-year-old son to the Akedah, and the 37-year-old obviously picked up pretty quickly what was going to happen, he's not a kid, and he lay down on the Akedah, put out his neck and said, Father, shech me in the best way you can. So who is like most praiseworthy there? Who is most like the most self-control, the biggest test? Presumably Yitzchak. And he doesn't mention anywhere it was a test for Yitzchak. It's a test for Avram. So it's much more logical that Yitzchak was just a kid. How old? So he said he can't have been 5, like some people say, why not? Because he was carrying the wood. Again, svara, logic, pshat.
But if you're picking, like, running animals in the water when she's 3 years old...
Oh, but don't you understand? Who says Rivka was 3 years old? It's the same question, meaning only if you say all the things came together do you say that Rivka was 3 years old, because Yitzchak was 37. But what if Yitzchak was only 8, 9, 10, like he says, at the Akedah, meaning that's why Avram can't tell him what he's going to do to him, because otherwise he's going to run. He's going to be off. He's going to run across the hills and never see him again. But if you say more on a spur that Yitzchak was a little boy, then the whole thing with Rivka, they're not chronologically linked. Or maybe they are. Maybe Rivka was born when Yitzchak was 6, or 8, or 10. Meaning by the time Yitzchak was 40, she was a woman in her 20s, 30s. Ah, but that's not what they taught you in grade school, because they taught you the drash, according to Rashi. Says the Ibn Ezra, fine, if that comes down from Sinai, then I'm not going to argue. Who am I to argue? But if not, then it doesn't seem logical. So let me ask you a question. So how old was he?
Okay.
That's the answer. Meaning, he can't have been both 37 and 12. He can't have been. That's just illogical. And therefore, how old was he? The answer is, it doesn't matter. So if it doesn't matter, why they argue about it? Because they what? That's not a good answer. No, that's not a good answer. They both got other things to get on with in life. You know, Rashi was a wine merchant. He can go off and make some wine, make some money out of it. Why is he writing stuff that he's only writing it because he thinks it's important. What can we learn?
That obviously Yitzchak had a tremendous amount of Mesir Nefesh.
Right. In other words, how old Yitzchak was is incredibly important on a religious level in terms of the pshat and the message. Because what am I learning from the Akedah? I also need to learn from the Akedah, otherwise it wouldn't be in the Chumash. So what I learned from the Akedah if Yitzchak was 12 is completely different from what I learned from the Akedah if he was 37. Do you see that? Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Meaning, it's a moral message, it's an ethical message, it's something which is impacting on my life. I don't read it just because that's what Rashi wrote and that's what he does. I read it because it's important for me to know this. And Rashi thinks it's important for this reason, and Ibn Ezra thinks it's important for that reason. But nobody is really arguing necessarily on how old he was. Because the historical truth, we'll see at the end, other people say the historical truth is secondary.
Why not just say what we can learn from it?
Why not just say don't eat meat and milk together? Why say don't cook a kid in his mother's milk? Because you could ask that question about every single line of the Chumash. Why like this, not like that? It's a good question. And the answer is because also it wants us to learn, it wants us to go deeper, it wants us to treat it seriously and learn out from it. But there are multiple ways to read it on purpose. It's a piece of writing that came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that lends itself automatically to different understandings.
The Torah is not history.
The Torah is definitely not a history. Is that too hot?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, it was really cold before, I'm sorry.
Just
pass it. So, it's really critical to understand that. Even to the point, and I'm going to say something challenging now, which I want you to understand correctly. Pshat. What is pshat? Tell me what pshat means.
Simple.
Simple? Not very simple. That's very complex. What does Pashut mean? No, that's not what Pashut means. In modern Hebrew it is. What's Lishot mean in Lashon HaKodesh? Spread out. Means it's the superficial top layer. It's not simple and it's not literal.
Is it like general?
General maybe, a little bit more. Taken at face value. Logical, contextual, grammatical, okay? That's what pshat is. It is not necessarily historical. Meaning, don't tell me that pshat's what happened. I mean, if I'd have been standing there with a video camera, standing there at the Akedah, saying, let's do a bit, I know you don't do this with a video camera anymore, but okay, and even when I was a kid, you didn't do this anymore. But what would I have seen? And the answer is, I don't know. Because the pshat clearly goes in different directions, and maybe what I would have seen with a video camera is not relevant. It doesn't mean that we're completely uninterested in historical things. There was a historical Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and there was a historical Har Sinai, and there was a historical Mitzrayim. But what the exact details of how the Pasuk describes it is not necessarily a historical recording of what happened. Does that make sense? And it's not historical because if the historical truth is irrelevant to us. What we need is the religious truth, which is far more central and important. Have a look at the next example. Nimrod. So, come on, guys. Was he a tzaddik or was he a rasha? It does obviously matter, because the Chumash is telling us it matters. But, you know, comes along the Ibn Ezra and say, he was a tzaddik. He was a tzaddik. It's very interesting. You speak to Israelis. I've heard this so often from Jews, from Jewish people, mostly who live in Fuslaris. They say, I don't understand it. How can the Israeli secular people call their kids Nimrod? You ever heard people say that?
Yeah.
Kids are called Nimrod. I know of a kid who was called Nimrod, and the teacher, he went to live in Chutz La'aretz with his parents. The teacher refused to call him that. He wouldn't call him that because it's the name. He thought of another name for him. Rod. He called him Rod. That's right. As in Roderick. Okay? Because he wouldn't call him Nimrod. So why, tell me, why do Israeli secular people call their kids Nimrod? They don't call them Esav. Because on the Pshat level, you read the Psukim, and what was Nimrod? He was a good guy, he was a bad guy. Sounds like he was a great guy. Chazal come along and give us a whole, you know, background that Nimrod was a Rosha, Marusha, etc., etc. But if you learn like Ibn Ezra, let's face it, secular Israelis learn Tanakh, and they learn it totally on a Pshat level. Not even a Pshat level, they learn it without any Mephoshim, so they don't even learn Pshat. So probably what they learn is wrong in many, many ways, but they're certainly not learning it with Drash, but the Ramban goes nuts. The Ramban goes is very unhappy. He says, the Ibn Ezra, you've just made a tzaddik out of a Rosha, because we have a Kabbalah that he was a Rosha. Chazal knew he was a Rosha. Okay. So again, the man Nimrod himself. I'm not sure that we're that interested in the man himself. If I found, for example, some records, they associate Nimrod with Sargon. Sargon is not some character from The Lord of the Rings. Sargon was a king in ancient Assyria. Okay? I think the comments laughing. It's fine. Don't worry about it. So we know who he was, and some people associate Nimrod with Sargon. Say that's definitely the same guy. Let's say we dig up some ancient Akkadian records that point out that he was a good guy, who was a bad guy, this, that, and the other. It's not going to make any difference to the way I analyze it, because it's the analysis of the text that matters, not the analysis of the historical reality. And this comes out with the Mishkan very clearly. You have a pasuk that says the Mishkan looked like this. So, what are the two opinions in number 10 as to what the boards look like? Did you get this?
Number 10.
Yeah, number 10, where the Gemara analyzes the boards. So, one view says the boards look like this, and one view says the boards look like this. Like this. Okay? An amber at the bottom and an esper at the top, or an amber at the bottom and an amber at the top. And then learning from the pasuk in number 8, where it says the boards were yachdav, they were together, and also tamim. The word tamim, the Gemara says, implies they came to an end, okay? Whereas the word yachdav says that they were like symmetrical. So one says the boards are like this, and one says the boards are like that. So come on, guys. How do you say elu ve'elu on this? What does that mean? Were there boards in the Mishkan? Yes. Did they look like both of these? So, what does it mean, Elu ve'Elu? How can you say they're both Divrei Elokim Chayim? You're answering like the Gemara answered with the Pilegesh. Look, it was like this and like that. You know, they had two different Mishkans. One was like this. Difficult to say this. There's no evidence. We're talking about the Mishkan in the desert. There was only one ever.
When they moved.
They alternated. The Pasuk said all of them. Well, they obviously felt that it was important to know. So have a look for a second. Have a look, because you might not have got to it. Have a look at number 14 for a second. Tosfos. Tosfos comes along and addresses this. First of all, he gives the standard Elu ve'Elu discussion coming from the Gemara over there in Eruvin, which is where Elu ve'Elu is built up. But look at the end here. He says, take it from what is it? You know, see what it says, 483? In the middle? You got that, guys?
Yeah.
There's little 483 in the middle of source 14. So, first of all, Tosfos comes along, Tosfos of Rabbeinu Peretz, and says, in a standard halachic case, we say Elu ve'Elu. Why? Because, you know, Shivim Tanim, the Torah, 449 ways of looking this way, all the stuff that we learnt already. But then he says, Mikol Mokum, everyone got where I am? Mikol Mokum Kasha, Mimasim Shikfar Hayu. It's difficult when we come on to events, Maisim Shahayu, things that happened. Kugoyim Mizbeach. What, like the Mizbeach. The Chad Muchach Mikra, the Hayashishim. One view proves from the Pesukim that it was like this. The Chad Muchach Mikra, Shehay Eshim. And one view says it was like this. Well, that's difficult because they can't both be right. How can you possibly say, in other words, I understand when it comes to halacha, halacha is multifaceted. It's a good word for today. But when it comes to events, history is not multifaceted. How can you say just follow the majority there? What do you mean follow the majority? It happened one way. It only ever happened one way. If the majority say it happened the other way, that doesn't mean it happened that way. The answer is the gam kulu loy haya ele b'chadinyan. Of course, it only happened one way. There was only one mishkan. There was only one set of boards, and they only had one shape. Ele chad mukach mikra de bedin haya loy liyos kacha. But listen carefully. One of you is saying halachically, I think they should have looked like this. B'chad mukach mikra. The other is passing from the posik de bedin hayu loy. He thinks they liyos kacha. They should have been like that. What does it mean, the Elu ve'Elu? It means the mitoicha psukim from the text, yesh mashmud lemidrash kamoi, kamar ukamar. You could learn it this way or that way. Meaning, when it comes to that machloikus about the Mishkan, one view is saying, if I had been the posek for the Mishkan, I would have built it this way, based on the psukim. And the other one's saying, well, no, if I would have been the poetic for the Mishkan, I would have built it this way. But what do they have to say about the way the Mishkan actually looks? Nothing. They don't care. Why do they care? What difference does it make with the way the Mishkan actually looks? We are dealing with a text. How do you ever know what happened in history? Let me ask you a philosophical question. What happened in the 1500s?
Personal accounts.
Personal accounts get varied. You have multiple accounts of what happened in history.
You can trace back to, like, my great-great...
I understand, but how do you?
That's her personal.
How do you know she's right? How do you know her perspective was correct? Is your perspective?
Yeah, everyone getting the same.
Good.
I think that's something about like the Jesus problem that everyone has green tails about it. I wasn't just a one person thing, but I could hear it from the way that she.
I understand. You put together the evidence in 100 years' time when you're. But one second, hundreds of people agree on all sorts of things and they're not right. I'm telling you that in 100 years from now, most people will be telling them that my grandparents told me the Holocaust never happened. Okay? And you can argue until you're blue in the face. They'll say, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? Because you just want world sympathy. You say your grandparents tell you this, well, I mean, obviously not. Look what most people think. And you'll be crying out there, how can you say that? How can you say that? And even today, you know, people say, I once said something about the Israeli Arab issue to one of my colleagues at work, and she just rejected out of hand. She says, no, that can't possibly be right, that's just wrong. But clearly something which was correct, but she says, no, that's wrong. Meaning, how do you know what happened historically when everyone says something different? When all the records say something different? When all the archaeology says something different? And the answer is, you never ever know the truth, the historical truth. You can't. Something just fell from the ceiling. Or did you just flick your thing up? Don't worry about it. Is that a question on the material?
No, it's not like the rabbi, people don't deny or finish the position.
No, but I bet there are people who denied exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
Were the Spanish just doing this, doing that, or were they doing it for this reason or for that reason? Most people would. In other words, some historical events are difficult to deny because there are so many records. This is what Abby was saying. There's so much consensus. But again, at the end of the day, you don't know really what happened. Put it this way, if they can deny the Holocaust, they can deny the Spanish Inquisition. Maybe it's all a conspiracy.
But they don't.
But maybe there's a conspiracy in the world to make you think. It's a Protestant conspiracy to make you think there was a Spanish Inquisition. But actually, it's all been highly inflated. And it was just a few people, and they were really very nice about it all along. And even then, there have been people who are skeptics saying, can we ever even prove our own existence? Descartes came along and said, I think, therefore I am. Or, not think, I think, therefore I am, but I am thinking, therefore I must exist. Because even if you only think you're thinking, so then you're thinking. Yeah? Meaning, I don't know anything about you, Descartes would say. I don't know if you exist. Maybe you're just a construct of my dreaming imagination. But I know that I exist because, you know, I have some consciousness of myself. And even if that's only me thinking I have consciousness of myself, then there's a me who thinks I exist. If there's a me who only thinks I exist, then I exist, because there's a me who only thinks that. But
you might exist, you just might not be.
Yeah, I might not look like this. I might exist in a completely different reality, but I clearly there is a me, said he, and others disagree. Meaning, what I'm bringing you to is the idea that when in terms of historical reality, get away from the childish way of thinking that the Chumash is a record of what happened. The Chumash is not there to tell you what happened. Rav Hirsch talks about this as well. Just like the Chumash is not there to tell you science, not there to teach you geography. What is it there for? What is the purpose of the Chumash?
The Torah was written for the people that intended to learn.
Which is you and me and everybody else through history. Meaning we're meant to learn how to live our lives. So you'll see this amazing comment coming up now from Professor Shaul Lieberman. Yes. We did.
Right.
And we don't deny it was a historical event. But we don't celebrate it as a historical event. We don't stand up on Shavuos and say, God gave us the Torah, this is what, like American Independence Day. This happened on this day 3,400 years ago. No. We celebrate it as a current, relevant, religious event.
Right, no,
the fact that there was a historical reality behind it is secondary. It's true. We absolutely believe this. But it's not why we're interested in it.
Right, but I'm saying how...
Same thing. It's Mitzrayim is part of Matan Torah. It was Gula. We celebrate it for all the connotations it has. Gula, not because we came out of Egypt.
No, we're
not. We're not celebrating. We're remembering coming out of Egypt because you know, we're not just remembering coming out of Egypt. We're remembering coming out of Egypt because all of those things that it means and implies. What is Galut? What is Geula? What is redemption? What is God? What is Sinai?
But I'm not saying it in terms of us. I'm saying, if let's say people can sit there and deny the fact that 6 million Jews suddenly disappeared from the face of the earth.
Right.
And they say, well, it wasn't the Holocaust.
Right.
You know, I don't know how else I'm explaining it.
Right.
I'm saying, in terms of, if people say that national revelation is a way to prove that Judaism is the only true religion, because we had 66...
I understand. There is an element of that.
I'm saying, if it's only written down in the Torah, and we're the only people who said it happened, how can we use that as a proof?
Because at the end of the day...
I mean, who said it happened?
At the end of the day, no one can tell you anything about whether it happened or it didn't happen historically, because nobody was there. That's still here. Meaning, all that anyone has in order to establish historical reality is some kind of text, is some kind of Masorah. That's all you have. And at the end of the day, you choose which Masorah you believe. Meaning, all those people out there that say it didn't happen, almost none of them have ever looked into whether it did happen or didn't happen. They just say that because that's the narrative. That's what people say.
How do we know? I mean, if we're reading the Torah, it says in the Torah that it happened, then we say,
right. Because we believe the Torah is Min HaShamayim. Why do we believe the Torah is Min HaShamayim? Because we have a Masorah that is Min HaShamayim. It's the foundation of our belief system. I understand, but at the end of the day, you're asking the wrong question. You're asking, how do I know that Har Sinai happened? What we're really trying to understand from the Chumash is that the Chumash is the truth. The Chumash is the text. We're just trying to understand what the text means. Now, how do I know the Chumash? It's like circular. How do I know the Chumash is true if Har Sinai never happened? The answer is because we have a Masorah from people that we trust. At the end of the day, you have to just decide which people you trust. You will never get clarity on things that happened thousands of years ago, except by saying, I trust these people, not these people, because what else am I going to do? And therefore I go with this position, not that position. It's all about Emunas Chachamim at the end of the day. And people who are secular that say they don't believe it, that's only because they've made a decision to trust a different set of people because it suits them to trust that set of people. But they have no more of a way of proving that anything did happen or didn't happen. Because no one can.
How can we say that they're wrong to listen to another set of people?
Again, when we say... because there are different sets of people that say all sorts of things, and if someone goes to a group of people who you don't think are right, so then you tell them that you're wrong. Meaning, if someone has a, you know, God forbid, a serious medical issue, and they go to a group of senior doctors who are in a hospital, and they say, do this. And then they go visit a bunch of witch doctors living in wherever it is, who shake bones, and they say, this makes the evil spirits go away, that's how we'll get rid of your cancer. So, well, I believe this group of people. Oh, but I believe this group of people. So you'll say to them, I'm sorry, you know, this group of people, for all the following reasons, I hold to be less reliable than the other group of people. But maybe the witch doctors have actually got something useful to say. There's all sorts of things that modern medicine can't do that somehow traditional medicine does. Everyone knows does that. But still, you can make a logical choice as to which group of people you feel is more authentic. Are you going to trust a bunch of people who don't know anything about it, who say it's all rubbish? Well, they have no reason to say anything because they don't know anything. So why should I even listen to them? Most people who object to religious people have no vested sort of learning, they have not invested in any way in it. Do I trust a bunch of academics who say there's no proof that this happened, therefore we reject it, when academic thinking is going to change 100 times in the next 100 years? And archaeology says for sure one thing today, and then tomorrow they dig something out of the ground, and the whole of archaeological thinking is turned over on its head. You have to sit down and work out which group of people do I most want to invest in, which is logical. But at the end of the day, you have no choice but to do that. Because what else are you going to do? I mean, that unfortunately, it's very puts the responsibility on you to make a decision like that. But most people who say, I believe scientists or academics, it's usually because it suits them to believe that way. If the scientists all came along and said everyone has to, work 23 hours a day and never sleep, then people would probably stop listening to the scientists because it doesn't go with their life narrative. You know what I mean? So people make all sorts of choices for all sorts of things. Look at this piece by Rabbi Shaul Lieberman. Shaul Lieberman was a fascinating individual. He was an Illui. He was for many years the head of the Harry Fishel Institute, which was learning Torah in Yerushalayim, that was founded by Rav Kook. Okay? He worked with Rav Kook in the 1930s. He's then one of these people who went to America during the 40s, and he ended up working for the conservative movement. He joined JTS, and there's a whole bunch of these people who were really orthodox, but they joined the conservative movement. The question is, does that make them conservative, or are they still orthodox and just work for the conservative movement? For us, it seems like a strange question today, because to us, in the 21st century, if you're in the conservative movement, then you're obviously not orthodox. But it wasn't quite the same in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. There were many Orthodox rabbis that worked in conservative schools because that's the only place they could get a job. Or taught in conservative schools because that's the only place they could get a job. Is that right? Is that wrong? I'm not getting into that now. But there were a few people like Rabbi Professor Lieberman, and Avraham Yeshua Heschel, my brain's not quite working in terms of my mouth today. But Avraham Yeshua Heschel, you've heard of Rabbi Heschel?
I like the Heschel School.
Yeah, I like the Heschel School. Told you my mouth wasn't working. The Heschel Shul and the Heschel School. How do you treat the writings of Rabbi Avraham Yeshua Heschel, who worked for many years in the Reform movement? In the Conservative movement, excuse me, not the Reform movement. Although people who knew him and saw him said there was no shiloh that he was conservative in his thinking or practice. So Rabbi Shaul Lieberman is another one of these people. Look at what he writes. My Maserah from my Rebbeim is that his stuff is important and authentic. That's why I've included it in the sheet. Have a look at what he says in number 13. You couldn't read number 13, right? I'm really sorry. It's the best I could do. I haven't got a better print. I'll try and find. Maybe I'll just type it out, for next year's students. But let's have a look at what he says. Fascinating idea. Adina, just shut the door, please. Hine, Bishnat Taf Reish Tadi Hay. Okay? So he's referring back to a writing that he did previously. Katavti, I wrote. This is 1935. Aleinu Litzayen. We have to look very carefully and identify. Sheyesh Lahavdil Ben Ta'ut Sofrim. There's a difference between a printing error. Sometimes there's a printing error in the book, it says the wrong word. Because it's come about, it's rooted, it's ultimately sourced in there just being lots of different manuscripts and no one could decide which is the right one, or a wrong manuscript was copied. Manuscripts generate printing errors, right? Because, people are copying them out and they obviously copy them wrong. Ubein Masora, and as opposed to a Masora, what's a Masora? Don't say tradition. What's a Masora? What does the word Masera literally mean? Come on, after 24 sheets of Makariz HaTorah.
Lineage. Pass down.
Pass down, transmission. That we have a transmission, Nechayna or Mutayit. Either correct or actually ultimately incorrect. But if we have a tradition, Shenit Kabla Ba'artos Yeduas, which is accepted in certain places, so he says, that's different from a printing error. Aval Achshav, now he says, I see, Roe Ani Shitzarek Levarer, that I need to clarify Laharchiv Et Divarai, that I need to expand on what I said before. Hainu, and what I mean is this, She'aleinu Lahavdil Ben Ha'emet Hamuchletet, we have to distinguish between absolute truth, historic, I mean, it was only one thing happened historically, Ubein Ha'emet Shalat Text. What's a text? A text. There is something called textual truth. Textual truth, which at the end of the day, Michal, is actually much more reliable than historical truth. Because historical truth, at the end of the day, you only have to theorize what it means. Think about this. I can only ever suggest, based on the evidence, that this is what happened. But I might be wrong. They might discover different evidence. There might be a conspiracy. But textual truth, if you give a valid reinterpretation of the text, that is textual truth. There's no shaila whether it's true or not. It's true, because that is a valid interpretation of the text. So you have come to a deeper MS with the text than you could ever do with history. We take history very seriously, and we believe what it says in books, but often it just says that in books because that's what they wrote. The Rambam writes in one of his tshuvas, in one of his letters actually, he says, I get very, very upset with people when I tell them something, if they ask me, is that written down anywhere? Like, and so, here, give me a piece of paper. Look, it's in writing. The answer is, like, what does it matter if it's written down anywhere? Someone just took the time to write it down and print it. Doesn't mean it's any more true. But a textual interpretation, which is true, that's an emes shel text. Ha'emes ha'historit, hi achad v'rak achad. There's only one historical truth. Aval ha'emes shel text, but textual truth, v'yuchadin text, depends on the text. So multiple textual truths. Kol text v'text v'ha'emes shel, each text has its own truth. V'fi ha'makor shemimenu sho'ev, depending on the root from which it comes. V'in yeshinu begirsat ha'mishnah. Look at this, an amazing statement. And this is him coming from a high academic. Rabbi Lieberman was an academic. He was a massive expert on Greek and Greek Hellenistic influences in ancient Palestine in the times of the Romans. So he was not some Rosh Hashiva sitting down. He was a Talmud Chacham of immense proportion. But he's not some Rosh Hashiva. By the way, his wife was the head for many years of the Shulamit girls' school. You ever heard of that girls' school? The girls' school in New York. It's an Orthodox girls' school in New York. Shulamit. Yeah. Shulamit, excuse me. Right. So where is it exactly? Brooklyn. So assume it's the same school. His wife was for many, 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 many years the head of that school, Mrs. Judith Lieberman. Okay, if it's the same school, you will have seen her name up there. So he says, "In yeshinu begirsas haMishnah, if there's a difference in versions in the Mishnah, bein habavli Yerushalmi." He was a big expert on Yerushalmi and Tosefta, very big. Said, "If you come, there was only one Mishnah, but sometimes the Mishnah quoted in the Bavli is slightly different to the Mishnah quoted in the Yerushalmi, and they both run from there." So he says, "Hari ha'emet ha'historit hirak achad." There's only one historical Mishnah. Okabavli or Kirushami, either this way or that way, or I suppose theoretically neither way, but it's certainly not both ways. He says, "Aval ha'emet shel ha'text," but the textual truth, "he b'mishas ha'bavli k'masoris ha'bavli," goes according to the Bavli in the tradition of the Bavli. "U'b'mishas ha'yushami k'masoris ha'yushami," and the Yushami like the transmission of the Rishami. Umisha Mashana et hagirsa, and if you want to change the girsa, the Mishnah, in the Mishnah, lefi ha'emis ha'historis, let's say you dug up the original Mishnah. You went digging around the north of Israel and you pulled out some clay pot which says, "I am Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and I was here." Yeah? And this is my Mishnah, and you took it to all the academics and you established, this is the original work of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. You broke it open, you brought out the original Mishnah. And now you say, well, now there's no Shaila anymore. Look, this is the original Mishnah. No one disagrees. So obviously that text is wrong and this text is right. He says, you can't do that. If you want to change the Mishnah, if the Ayim say, stir it, Hari hu matashtesh Maseras. You are destroying the Maserah. You're blurring the Maserah. V'chaita, and you're sinning, clapping hafaktar. That's not allowed. Think about this. If this would have been said by some big shtarka, Haredi, Rosh Hashiva, that, you know, you can't listen to the academics and you can't listen to the archaeologists, etc. So I would have said, oh, well, you know, he's not academic, you know, he doesn't... Excuse me, this is from Professor Lieberman. He's saying that if you dig up the history and think that's anything relevant, so what the truth, the MS, the Jewish truth is, it's not. We have something called textual truth. So the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban are arguing on textual truth. And the two versions are arguing on textual truth. And the hare and the fly are arguing on textual truth. Elu ve'elu dibrelikim chayim. Both of them are valid readings of the text, and I don't care what happens. Now, in fairness, that's not what the Gemara does there, but that's what all of these other sources are bringing you. And the last source, which I just want to mention, so you had a question, Abby, I apologize. Was it you? Was it Hani? Hani, you had a question. Right. The Dead Sea Scrolls. But the Dead Sea Scrolls, they dug up loads of different variations of the text in different ways. Let me ask you a question. There's not 100% agreement on what the exact text of the Sefer Torah is. There's very, very high agreement, which is unbelievably high compared to the variations in other significant religious texts of other religions. But it's not 100%. A few words here and there. Let's say I went to the Sinai Desert and I managed to dig up the authentic original Torah scroll. Which wouldn't be in the Sinai Desert anyway, it would be somewhere. It was buried with the Aron Kodesh. The Aron Kodesh was buried, okay, actually the scroll wasn't buried with it, the scroll got lost somehow. So let's say I found it and brought it into Shul and said, look, just change this word. You can't change this word. You can't change that word. We have a Maserah that it means this. Yeah, but I found the original. The answer is, great. put in a museum, it's great. It's not relevant because we have something called MS, a text. The truth of the text. This is very, very critical to understand. When you're learning Chumash, when you're trying to work out what it's doing, when you're at school and you're a kid, you think that the text, first of all, Midrashim. Forget about Midrashim. Kids at school, they learn Midrashim, they think this is what historically happened. Which is very easy to show that that's a very oversimplistic way of looking at it. Midrashim are not just to fill in the historic details. But not just Midrashim, even the text of the Pesukim themselves. You know that you don't always take them literally. When it says the Yad Hashem, is there a big hand coming down from heaven? Doesn't mean that. So what does it mean? It means something else. So why did it say that? Okay. So we have a complicated discussion about that. But historically, and again, don't get me wrong, girls, I'm not suggesting that there isn't a historical reality. There was an Avram, there was a Yitzchak, there was a Yaakov, and there was a Har Sinai, and there was a Mitzrayim. But you have to be a bit more subtle the way you understand it. Now, of course, this is a bit of a Pandora's box. Where do I take the Pesukim literally? Where do I not? That's where the Rambam and people like him come in with Yud Gimel Ikrim. Meaning, if you are undermining the Yud Gimel Ikrim, then that's a problem. But if you're not, then it's not necessarily a problem. Now, I just want to point out, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but... Oh, so let's talk about that now. In number 11, where we talk... I'm not going to read the whole thing through, because we don't have 6 or 7 minutes. I'll just pick out bits of it. Rav Huttner. Now, Rav Huttner and Rabbi Professor Shaul Lieberman are probably, like, at different ends of the spectrum in many ways, but they make the same hashgafic point about Elu ve'Elu in historical things. He asked a question of the Krashi of Mishkan. He asked this question here. And what does he say? He says a fascinating thing. The Mishkan was buried. He was put into Geniza. What does it mean when we put something into Geniza? We put it on hold. We put it on ice. Meaning, for us now, it's not just it's under the ground somewhere. For us now, it no longer exists as a physical reality. It's in Geniza. It's out of play. It's finished. It's out. So what do we have now in terms of the Mishkan? What we have now, what the Mishkan is now... is the text of the Mishkan, is the Psukim of the Mishkan. That is the Mishkan. So how was the Mishkan built? Maybe like this, maybe like this. The Mishkan which is lying somewhere under the ground on Har Habayit, it's not relevant anymore. Because that thing was put in Geniza. He says, maybe when the future Sanhedrin comes and everything is up for grabs, the whole shaft is reopened and all those things are taken out of Geniza, okay, then we can talk about a whole new approach to things. But in the meantime, this stuff in Geniza, because it's just like a physical thing can be in Geniza, an idea can be in Geniza, and what is left, what we have left is the text, which we understand the way we understand it. I just want to pick out 2 or 3 lines. Have a look, please. You know, on page 3. Turn to page 3, please. Okay. Here, look here. It's about 12 lines down. The line begins Al Inyano or Binyano. You got that? Shal Mishkan, yeah, Yudunu Legniza. You got that, guys? There's a full stop. It says Ella. You with me? Let's just finish with this. Ella Shebizman Shemakom Gnizato Shel Guf HaMishkan Hu Bechlala De Alma. Okay, when the actual place of the Mishkan is now in a pit, it's in a void. It's, we don't know where it is. Now the concept of the Mishkan is something which has been given over to the Chachmei Amasera. And obviously when there is a specific issue on the Mishkan that is relevant to us now in Halacha, for whatever reason to be discussed, as in Chacham Michachmei Amaseru Shal Torah Shebal Peh Loi Kiven El Hamitziu El Mitziotah Shel Guf HaBinyan, then if one of the rabbis who is discussing it doesn't actually get it right in terms of the physical nature of the Mishkan, Hari Dafka Al Yidei Zeh Kiven L'Ritzoyin Shel Makom, but it's only he only does what God wants him to do by using his seichel, because there is no Mishkan anymore. It's buried. It's finished. It's out of play. Therefore, the Mishkan is what this Chacham says. The text says the Mishkan is. That is the Mishkan. So he's not wrong. Because this is what God wants. But now there's the idea and not the thing itself. Therefore, halacha that comes out from this chacham, this is the true halacha. Ah, you're going to say, well, I'm going to dig under Harabai, find you the original Mishkan, and I'll prove you wrong. Together with the Aron Kodesh. Actually, there are many different sheets as to where the Aron Kodesh is, but the Rambam passage of the Aron Kodesh is under Har HaBayis. That's what generates the Kedushas Har HaBayis. Very interesting. The Kol Mitzius Yesh La Emet Shelah. Oh, Each different reality has its own truth. There's a truth to Torah, which is the truth of the text. It's exactly, obviously he's not going to quote Rav Shaul Lieberman, but he's saying almost exactly the same thing. And the Metzias HaTorah, the textual Metzias, is what God wants from us. So when two rabbis, two of the Amoraim, are arguing the Mishkan look like this and the Mishkan look like that, Perish Machlokes who, Kesad Nigdita Lefaneinu Achshav Tzmonot Kodshei HaMishkan. How do we today understand the Mishkan? Not how does it look there. Look, I've said the point a number of times. You probably got it by now. He talks at length about it. It's very, very, very interesting. You should read this piece at length. At the end, look at what he says at the end. Let me finish with this and give Rav Hutner the last word. I brought you a nice picture of him as well. Give Rav Hutner the last word. On page 4. Hishtadalti lahazbilacha et ha'inyan. I try to explain this to you. Kefi advarim sha'ala oisam b'hakulmas b'sha'a zo b'yadi. As far as I can express myself with my pen at this time. It could be that I haven't yet given you enough information on this issue. Maybe you need to be looking more at it. If that's the truth, don't hesitate, guys, he says. Tell me straight away. What's not clear to you yet? I'll try and make them clearer. Chen dibarta, you've said absolutely right. Dvarim halalu, these things, heim even hashtia, they are the very foundation stone, shel emunah Torah Shebal Peh. They are the foundation of Torah Shebal Peh. And that's what this whole course is trying to do, from Torah to Torah, is trying to give you a sophisticated understanding, a nuanced approach to what Torah Shebal Peh is. It's not just some little bunch of information that was given to Moshe and passed on. It's not just some historical, like trying to get it right, historically. That's never ever going to be possible to anyone in any system. It's much more focused on analysis, text, thinking, etc. Maybe that's one of the reasons why the Navi, according to the Rambam, is less relevant than the Halacha, Chacham Adif Minavi, because, like, what's the Navi telling me that I need to know? I don't need to know the reality in heaven. I need to know lots of very important things, and Rav Hutner told you they're very important, and don't hesitate to ask questions on them if you have questions on them. Maybe I can't answer them. Certainly I can't answer them to the same degree as Rav Hutner, but I'll do my very best.
Thank you.